Listeners, the team at Author Accelerator knows that all kinds of people can make good book coaches. It's not necessarily people who have had massive success as writers themselves, and it's not necessarily people who have secured agents, book deals, degrees, or awards. It's people who really could spend all day talking about books, other people's books, who get excited by the idea of lifting up other writers and who are ready to back up their passion for writing with skills, training, and hard work. If that might be you, join the Author Accelerator team for 2 days of exploration on November 30th and December 1st, 2022, to find out if 2023 will be the year you launch a book coaching business or level up the one you already have. Head to bookcoaches.com/dreamjob to learn more.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. Try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Delantonia, and this is Hashtag Am Writing, the weekly podcast about writing all the things, short things, long things, fiction, pitches, proposals. This is the podcast about sitting down and getting your work done. And I am KJ Delantonia, the author of several novels, The Chicken Sisters in Her Boots, and the not particularly immediately forthcoming, but I'm super excited about it, Playing the Witch Card. I am also the former editor and lead writer of The Motherlode at the New York Times. And I'm solo today, except that with me is our guest. She is Allison Gilbert. And she does not say Gilbert. I know someone who does, so I have this moment of like, ooh, Alison Gilbert.
Yeah.
And we will.
A different Gilbert, a different Gilbert.
This interview totally with fake French accents. I have known Allison for a really long time. We go back to the New York days together. And Allison, right now, and most importantly, is the author of, or co-author of, Listen World, the first biography of, as they keep saying, the biggest female journalist in history that you have never heard of, which I love. She is American writer Elsie Robinson, and newspaper columnist who came from nothing and became the most read woman in the country, and the highest paid woman writer in the William Randolph Hearst staff, stadium, media empire. So that's her current gig. She's got a big, fast gig co-hosting a documentary about women journalists of 9/11. She's the voice of what you hear when you go into the 9/11 memorial. She has a huge history of talking to people about that experience and also about other grief experiences and writing about those. She's got other books about the loss of parents and keeping memories alive. So this is a big pivot for her, and I really want to talk to that and about that. And she is sitting here. I can see her because we're on Zoom, although y'all don't get that piece of it. Mostly because Serena's head was blow off. I just put that out there. If I was like, sometimes I'm like, let's do video, and yeah, she would. That is never going to happen, friends. Anyway, I can see Allison nodding madly away. So hi, welcome. Thanks for being here.
So happy to be here, KJ. Love the intro.
Yeah, so let's talk for just a second about, we're going to talk about Elsie. We're going to talk about Elsie's writing. We're going to talk about biography. We're going to talk about so many things that it's going to go crazy. But I did want to talk for a minute about that change, because it is a pivot. And it is also reflected in your biography materials that you've really kind of just gone like, nope, I'm the writer of this book. And kind of put the other extremely high profile and important stuff, you kind of tucked it aside. So I'd love to hear how and why.
Well, the why, I guess I'll start there. The book grabbed me nearly 30 years ago, and it really wasn't a book then. It was just a seed. It came from the experience of losing my mom. I was cleaning out my childhood home, and I was packing up my mom's books, and something fell out of one of her books. It was a piece of paper that she had folded up so many times it was squished, like a piece of squished origami, and it fell out to the floor, and I unfurled it really carefully because it was that old onion skin paper. And my mom had retyped a poem about grief, and the poem was called Pain, P-A-I-N, and it was attributed to someone named Elsie Robinson. And it was the most tough love poem about pain I had, pain and loss and grief, that I had ever read. It was like a slap across my face that basically said, be thankful you had a mother worth missing. And wow. I just wanted to know who Elsie Robinson was. And that's what put me on the path of a very, very slow burn getting this book underway.
So it really comes from the same place that everything that everything you do comes from. Well, and I don't mean that in like a bad, like you only think about sad things. I mean, it's, you know, you come from a really holistic place of seeing all the passages of life. And this came from there too. I can't believe it. I'm surprised.
Yeah, you know, it was, it's kind of like that old adage, which for me has been true for much of my writing, not all of it, but much of my writing has been coming from a place that I know, or I felt, or it was personal to me. And hopefully, if I do my job right, bringing back, you know, scaling back and making it applicable to more readers, not just myself. It wasn't like diary entries that I was interested in writing or journal entries. I wanted to write articles and books and essays. I wanted to kind of pull back the curtain and make my experiences broadly applicable. But this Elsie Robinson name, it really was a fluke. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that she would still be completely lost to history even today if my mother hadn't died. And how weird is that?
That is very bizarre. So I want to talk about Elsie in a minute, but I just want to touch on the choice to present yourself sort of fresh in the world of Elsie Robinson. When I read about this book, when I look at your bio, I don't see a lot of the really impressive stuff that you have done before. And I wonder if that was your choice, if it was something that publicists suggested. How did that come about?
It's such a great question. And I am such an avid listener of #AmWriting that I love the idea of being able to kind of talk this through and really be candid about some of these decisions that I made. It wasn't really a publicist or my agent. It was just a matter if I was going to make this pivot to become a biographer, which is hella daunting, really hard, harder than any other book project I've ever done. It's my fifth. So I have a little bit of track record to say it's the hardest for sure. That I didn't want to conflate it with some of my grief work. I wanted to bring down the grief work, so to speak, if you're doing like an octave meter, bring down the grief work and heighten some of the work that I have done that elevates women's stories, because that would go to where I'm moving with this book. And so for the 20th anniversary of 9/11, I was really fortunate to work with the National September 11th Memorial Museum to do a 20-part series about the women who covered 9/11. And so those become the threads that I wanted to like underscore and highlight, because they felt more in keeping with this particular project. But I'm not abandoning by any stretch all of the grief work at all. And I think for two reasons. One, we just talked about the origin story, and I have felt so connected to my mom writing this book. And so to me, that is about keeping the memories of loved ones alive, because I got to think about what about Elsie's writing likely appealed to my mother that she had kept this poem for so long. Mm-hmm. And then the other side too is that Elsie Robinson writes a lot about grief and loss. And I found that particular theme of her writing. I mean, she wrote about so many topics, racism, capital punishment, feminism, women's studies, but she also wrote about loss. And I just, sometimes, KJ, I would read Elsie's words about grief and loss. I'm like, I wish I could have written that. Like, it's so good.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many things that I love about this, but one of them is this, you know, I think we all sometimes feel like we're discovering issues anew. And then, you know, you come across a writer that has already expressed some of the things that you're saying and, you know, done it better or done it differently or you know, done it first. Or there are so many ways to think of it. And I think celebrating the people that came before us, especially women, who's so often the things that we did were not lionized, have not been, you know, saved in the Library of Congress other than like in the basement shoved, you know, underneath a big stack of papers or whatever. To bring those voices back, that's really exciting. So
it was funny because as my co-author Julia Shears and I were writing this book, there was one particular Elsie Robinson quote that I was like, oh my gosh, this is so hashtag am writing. Can I read it to you
yes,
guys?
Please.
Okay. So it was on the importance of stamina when it comes to writing. And I have to say, you know, for more than 40 years, she was a daily newspaper columnist.
Oh my gosh.
So she had to like turn it out. Mm-hmm. It was like being a blogger before bloggers existed, but the quantity at some weeks was 6 days a week. It was madness. And here's what she said, you know, when you say keep your butt in the chair, here's what she said. It is the parked profile, not the divine spark, which is the secret of success.
Yeah, the parked profile. That's such a nice way of saying, but.
But is that not just, and that was written, by the way, in 1934.
Yeah. I mean, when you wrote me about her before you had the book out, I was just floored and also fascinated. There, you know, she's not the only woman that was out there making this same noise. I mean, Laura Ingalls Wilder was a daily newspaper columnist for part of her life. You know, and I personally, all listeners know, I've been fascinated with Shirley Jackson at the moment and her journalism versus her novel career. So I love that we're getting a chance to hear some. So tell us about Elsie before we even get into the writing about her, which is where we're going to focus. But I think people, you know, y'all listeners may often hear an episode and think, well, I'm not super interested in the subject of that biography, but I'm interested in writing biography. So let's talk writing. And while all of that is true, the weird meta thing here is that, as this quote tells you, I mean, we're all interested in this writer because we are this writer. So tell us about Elsie.
Yeah. So in brief, because I know we want to talk about craft and not really completely her story, but you hit on this a little bit when we first started talking at the top of the show. She came from nothing but had this burning desire to create, to craft, to write. She was born in the late 1800s. And so when she was coming of this age where she wanted to put thoughts on paper, it was in like the 1915s, the 1918s, 1920s, and women were really contained. They did not have as many outlets to share their points of view as they do today. And she wanted a bigger, richer life. So even before she got the platform, which she ultimately did in 1924, before that, she decided that going for her dream was worth everything. She left her husband in 1912 to go forth. Not a thing at all. It sounds so kind of roll your eyes today to leave your husband to go fulfill this dream. Maybe not roll your eyes. I mean, of course, it's very serious, but it was just not done. You were, you know, branded, you know, many awful things. Some women, it was so bad to be considered a divorced woman that someone would rather be called a widow than to admit that they were divorced. There was stigma attached, but she left anyway because she needed to do something that would fill her heart and her mind. And she did it there forward as a single mom of a chronically ill child. And so she had some chutzpah, as they say. She really had some guts and some moxie. And her grit is what I found really inspiring.
Oh, I just want to spend just a minute on how she got from, you know, it's not like she's William Randolph Hearst's great-granddaughter here, right? I mean, so she's coming at this from out of left field. And I would just like to spend just a minute on her determination and some of the things that she did that I know have reminded you of some of the things that people do today.
Well, to me, what was so remarkable is that for a 3-year stretch between 1915 and 1918, to make ends meet, she became the only female gold miner in this one particular mine in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, where she literally worked 600 feet below the surface of the earth, risking her life. I mean, this was dangerous work. And at night, after she would walk 4 miles to the mine, work all day, walk 4 miles back, put her son, you know, into the room, clean him up after, you know, his day and get him ready for bed and do the homework and turn off the light. Then by candlelight with a manual typewriter, she taught herself how to type and then would send these manuscripts to publishers in New York and Boston. And this is from, like, I would say a ghost town type place in California. It's called Hornitos, California. Back then, it had like no one living there, just a few people. And she would take these pages to the post office, weigh them, pay the postage, send them off to some foreign land, you know, New York or Boston, and just wait for the editor to say yes or no. And she did end up beginning to be published. And so by the time the mine shut down and she went back to the Bay Area, that's when she really got her toehold and got her first job at the Oakland Tribune.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So props to Elsie. And I, you know, y'all really do want to read this book. It's called, just in case we don't mention it enough times, Listen World, How the Intrepid Elsie Robinson Became America's Most Read Woman. And, you know, you'll be inspired and amused and interested, and probably you want to give it to all your friends for the holidays. So that being said, how did you come to this book in this form? And how did you hook up with Julia Shears, who is your co-author?
Well, boy, did I need Julia Shears. I mentioned to you that, you know, it was about 30 years ago that I found out about Elsie Robinson. And about 11 years ago, I talked to my literary agent and I said, this is the project. I must do this biography. I had found out enough about her in those intervening years to know that I had enough material to move forward. And for the next 8 years, the next 9 years, I had other projects, other books. I just kept writing, putting it down, writing and putting it down. And not putting it down because I lost interest, KJ, putting it down because I could not figure out how to tell the story in a way that I was envisioning. Like, I was a genius when I was like going off to sleep, or I was a genius in my dreams of how I was going to put this book together. And then when the laptop opened and it was me trying to make it work, it wasn't working. And so enter Julia Shears, who together, we banged it out. And I just, this would not be written truly without Julia. She is an incredible narrative nonfiction writer. And I come from, you know, journalism. You know, I come from working in TV news. That's my old background. It's a very different skill set. And I think we really, we're just a dynamic pair. And I just, my hat is always off to Julia.
So was it, do you think it was, I don't know, since Julia's not here, I'm kind of tackling this from your point of view. Do you think it was the need to carry a story structure for so long that made this such a challenging switch from journalism?
No, I think it was. Julia is a master at all forms of writing that I am not. So what I mean by that is she's really good at things, KJ, that you're really good at now, like narrative tension and, you know, potentially dialogue or how to create moments where you just want to worry about the pacing and making sure you're getting to that next scene. And those were not skill sets that I was practiced at. Mm-hmm. What I am really exceptional at, and I think we all have our skill sets that we are very confident in, I know how to research and I know how to find things and I know how to talk and get anyone on the phone and I know how to find the hidden nugget of information that will just make a scene pop. And I'm really good at coming in after and saying, this is what we're missing. Here's how I think we should flow this next narrative piece into the next one. Or I think we're missing the landing here. Let's end it a little bit differently. And so then it became this wonderful collaborative, like teamwork experience. And that's the world that I have come from. I come from a newsroom world where
Julia? Did you know her ahead of time or how did you guys find each other?
I knew her ish through different writer friends, but no, we didn't know each other at all. But this is how I found her. So when I knew I wanted to have a partner, when I knew that this book was not going to get done if I didn't bring on a partner, I had two primary initial criteria.
Oh, wait, I have one quick pre-question for you.
Yes.
Did you have a publisher at this point or an agent or you're just?
Oh, I definitely had my agent. My agent was completely on board. The proposal that I was working on for this book, as I mentioned before, it just wasn't gelling.
Okay, so it's the proposal that's not gelling. Okay,
yes,
so you've got criteria.
It was a proposal that wasn't gelling. So we knew we had a book. We knew we had a proposal that needed some real kind of help. And so that's when I was kind of, well, it's either I get help at this point after, I guess, 9 years on and off. I mean, I have other books come out in the interim. I didn't put it away and shelve it forever. But here's what Julia brought to the table. I really wanted another woman. This is a woman's biography of an exceptional trailblazer. And I really wanted to partner with another woman writer. And that woman writer, for me, had to be in the San Francisco Bay Area. Because I'm based in New York and much of Elsie Robinson's life does in fact take place on the East Coast. So I could cover by foot, you know, if I needed to go to archives and get on land and see things that Elsie had seen, I could do that. And then in theory, the writer on the West Coast could then cover the archives there. And so for me too, it was a financial decision. My biography is expensive. Traveling to these locations, going to archives are not necessarily free.
Right.
So a lot of their materials cost money to reproduce, to photocopy. So it's not nothing.
Biography, the most expensive.
Well, you know what? It actually is.
No, I believe you.
It's actually fascinating. There are awards actually given out to help biographers fund their research because it's quite costly.
Tell us about something that you guys discovered in the process of this spy. Like, give us a story of sort of how that footwork happens and pays off.
Oh, well, the greatest, most exciting discovery that we made together. I actually did, in fact, fly to California for one of our research trips because, of course, I couldn't resist. You know, we went back to the California gold mining town where Elsie Robinson worked for 3 years between 1915 and 1918. And we drove there and we found the owner of the ranch. Currently the ranch, but it's where the mine was. And so we got to walk the land that Elsie walked when it was, in fact, the gold mine, which was incredible. But in the town is really the most incredible discovery. In the old abandoned post office that had been closed since the mid-1950s, shuttered behind padlocks, we were allowed to go in there. Risky, because it was dilapidated and, I mean, I won't gross you out, kind of disgusting and vermin nice. And you can imagine.
Ew.
But in the back storage room, underneath a cover, was an old Smith Premier manual typewriter. And we did our fact checking and we compared the years that that particular typewriter was manufactured and where it would have been made available for purchase in those years that Elsie was there. And we believe 99% with certainty that that in fact was the typewriter that Elsie Robinson used
to
type and submit her manuscripts. And we include those photographs in Listen World.
So she probably, when she was moving, was like, well, it's time for me to have a new, I mean, like anybody, right? It's time to get a new laptop. Anyway, I'll leave this one behind. You know, people here can, I'll clean it out. You don't have to do that with a typewriter, but you know, I'll leave this for other people to use because it's time for me to move up. Wow.
Well, the most amazing thing about that typewriter, by the way, it actually belonged to the woman who ran the post office, a dear friend. It became a dear friend of Elsie Robinson's. She was the daughter of a former slave, and she had given Elsie that typewriter with her own description of it already being ancient and old. And when you think about a manual typewriter being ancient and old, here's just one bit of detail that I'm sure your listeners will appreciate. There were double the number of keys on the typewriter. And why? Why were there like literally two alphabets?
Capitals and not?
Because the shift key had not been invented yet.
Wow.
Can you imagine?
No. Just no.
Yeah.
I cannot. I mean,
it's awful. Could you imagine typing your manuscripts that way? Awful. I can't.
I can't even, you know, everybody knows I've been super fascinated by Shirley Jackson lately, and I can't even really imagine like typing and then pulling the sheets out and then scribble. And I actually, you know, I'm old enough, you're old enough. I used a typewriter when I was little. I never had to actually edit on one, but wow.
Yeah.
A different key for a capital A than a small A.
Yeah. Before
I never even thought about it.
It's crazy. It's nuts. And so that's why we included that photograph in Listen World. But at every turn, it became, I can't complain about writing a book. I have a computer. You know, I can't complain about not having time to write. I don't work in a gold mine. I don't walk 4 miles to my shift and work 9 hours.
It's like having a really awful parent standing over your shoulder going, uphill, both ways, in the snow, in July.
It just, you know, KJ, just kind of puts things in a little bit of perspective.
Okay, well, fine.
Not to say writing still isn't hard. It just, you know, the circumstances can also be a little bit more challenging too.
Did you guys ever think about turning this into fiction? I was thinking about the book, The Personal Librarian, that's out now. That's by two writers, and it's about J.P. Morgan's personal librarian, who was a woman about the same era, little later, but she was black passing as white. It's a really interesting story, but they fictionalized it. So I was just wondering if you guys gave that any thought.
Not for a second. You know, Julia is a journalist too, and we really wanted to dig deep into her life. And it's the first biography.
I know. Yeah.
And so for us, it's like so many women's histories have been completely erased. Mm-hmm. And for us to then fictionalize who we are then saying is this pioneer, someone worthy of.
But you're not interesting enough. We're going to make it fiction. I get it.
Yeah. And so I felt that that would actually be a disservice to her.
How did you pick? I mean, it's a whole life, a whole fascinating life. How did you how did you choose what to include and what to leave on the floor?
Yeah, you know what? It was a very interesting conversation. a biography, you clearly have a choice of doing birth to death. We certainly cover
Birth
to death, but really it's a fade to black when she starts becoming famous.
Mm.
Because once the struggle is over,
yes.
Julie and I felt that you know, it's kind of at some point boring to hear about someone's fabulous, you know, success. I mean, it's wonderful to achieve it. It's wonderful to know that she reached that mountaintop and stuck for so long. I mean, her reign, so to speak, was from 1924 to 1956. In fact, she wrote, KJ, so much copy.
Wow.
What was remarkable, they kept running Elsie Robinson columns. You know, her column was called Listen World. That's mm-hmm. why the book is called yes. Listen World. And the Listen World column kept going after she died because she had submitted so much copy ahead of time that there was enough in the kind of, you know, Elsie Robinson slush pile
wow.
to kind of keep it going after her death. I mean, it's remarkable.
That must have, I mean, do you think you read it all?
Oh,
like, I mean, that's such a, it's like contemporaneous accounts of everything from, you know, the Depression through World War II, past World War II into, you know, the era of the atomic age. Wow.
Yeah, it's really incredible. She covered the bonus march on Washington in the 30s. She was dispatched to cover the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. I mean, she also covered breaking news. By our estimates, she wrote about 9,000 columns, articles, essays. We haven't touched on her poetry. She was an incredible poet. And last, we also didn't talk about yet what truly made her a unicorn and why Julie and I both believe that's why she got top dollar and why William Randolph Hearst himself was negotiating her contracts is because she also drew her own editorial and political cartoons.
Oh, wow.
Normally, writers write, and then the art department takes care of the editorial or political cartoons that accompany those columns. She did it both. She did both.
Wow.
And that's
how can we never have heard of this person?
I know.
This is crazy.
Yes. That's why we fell in love. We mm-hmm. fell in love with her. I was in love with Elsie. In fact, the editorial team, the publicity team, the marketing team, we all started calling ourselves Team Elsie. And so whenever we would have group emails, it was Team Elsie because we were all so excited to resurrect her legacy. It's just remarkable how much of a steady erasure of women's stories there have been. And if this can help not only resurrect Elsie Robinson's story, but elevate others, that would just be a win.
Wow. So one of the things that interested me about Elsie and the reasons that I asked you to come on is that she was not just a writer herself, but a champion of other writers, you know, who sort of felt like, well, I could learn to do this. You can too. She was kind of the lessons in chemistry heroine, only the journalist version. So talk a little bit about her. Give us some Elsie writing encouragement before we shut this down, as we're going to have to.
Well, she would be the first one to say that no one is anointed a writer. It's not like someone is going to pluck you out of the crowd and say, you know what? You are the writer that we've been waiting for. She created that role, that position for herself. And I think we all can, right? We all have that burning in our belly. You wouldn't be listening to this podcast otherwise. And so to know that you can pluck yourself, you can anoint yourself is definitely an Elsie-ism. She would also say that the key to writing is, guess what? Writing. And not thinking about writing, not potentially planning on writing or creating the most incredible workspace for writing, and not fretting if you didn't have 3 hours of quiet, you know, the perfect idyllic place to write. Just writing is key to writing. And then she would say, which is related, and I'm going to quote this one, forget the excuses. If you want to write, find a way to fit it into your life. You know, I've heard you guys talk before, you know, it's before the piano lesson or it's in the car during soccer practice. I mean, I remember writing past books, literally sitting outside, like hearing like my daughter in gymnastics, you know, and getting stuff done. It's just a matter of what you can get done in these little blocks of time. And so she has these wonderful isms because she really thought there was no special badge that you needed, just to go ahead and do it.
And I know you have these on your website, so we will link to Elsie's writing manifesto and also her top five quotes on writing for everybody enjoy. Well, this is fantastic. I think we could talk forever, but I would love to take a little pause and then talk about what we've been reading. But before we even do that, what I miss, like, what's the one thing you'd love to share with, or is there anything that you'd love to share with Am Writing listeners about the process, about Elsie, about biography, about co-writing? Oh my gosh, we didn't even touch on that. One more thing we could just talk about for a sec before we shift to books.
I think it's a matter of being open to where the next story idea comes from. I had no idea when I was 25 and my mom had just died, that going through my mother's belongings would have given birth to such a transformative project for me. And it's just seeing things, sitting with things, not abandoning things when they're hard, and wrestling and being okay wrestling with a process for something that you ultimately feel passionate about. I had Elsie in my bones and in my blood. I couldn't shake her. And I don't think there was anything that was going to dissuade me. And I feel like just being open to the process, no matter how hard, if you are passionate about the topic, I truly think you can make it work, even if it means, like I had to do, bring in a partner. And yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I felt emboldened. I felt inspired by Julia. She was a gift to this process. It would not have been done without her. And so I just became humble. And I said the story was more important than doing it on my own.
Yeah. I love that. I mean, that's fantastic. And we're all glad that you pulled it off. So yay. And bringing Elsie back into the world. I mean, it's just, my mind just boggles at the whole thing. So, all right, we'll leave me boggling. We'll pause for a second and then we'll talk about what we've been reading. All right, you go first. What you've been reading?
All right. Well, there's two books. One I just re-picked up. It's called Lab Girl.
Ooh, yeah.
Have you read this one?
No, but Jess has.
Okay. So I am loving the idea of it. I guess it falls into that realm of a powerful woman's story. And since I'm on that Elsie kick, it really seems like a perfect one. And this is going to be, the second one is rather odd. It was from 1988. And it's by Dr. Joyce Brothers. And it's called The Successful Woman: How You Can Have a Career, a Husband, and a Family, and Not Feel Guilty About It.
And has it changed your life?
Well, I have to admit why I picked it up. You know, I talked about being exceptionally lucky that this biography, Listen World, has made me feel close to my mom, who died nearly 30 years ago. And in this book by Dr. Joyce Brothers, my mom was interviewed by Joyce Brothers. And so I was rereading some of my mom's quotes about how she balanced being a working mom, raising my brother and me. And so I just went back to my shelf because I wanted to reread a little bit more about how she was a working mom while I am living that life every day.
That is amazing. That's really cool. And also a little disturbing, because I have some books on my shelf that I've been interviewed for, and it's just a little weird to think about it from that perspective. Isn't that?
My mom had a quote about like when she would go shopping, and I felt that was so funny, like how she felt guilty about taking time for herself just to go to the store And I'm like, those are the conversations, because she died so young, that adult to adult. Mm-hmm. I was not a mom when she died. I wasn't married when she passed away. And so it's almost by reading these quotes, I got to kind of live and see and breathe and hear how she was a working mom. It's been really neat.
Wow. That's fantastic. Well, I've been on a reading slump.
Tiny
reading slump, which just means that everything I've picked up, I have also put down. So I'm trying to think of something that I have both read and enjoyed lately, that being our usual criteria. and I'm flailing. Oh, happily, I have this bag here of books I had offered. I've got something. And it's huge.
That is huge.
Totally finished it. So
what is that?
Kristen Higgins.
Okay.
It's Kristen with an A. She's super prolific. A writer we can all get behind and admire. She's written a lot of commercial fiction, women's fiction, whatever you want to call it. But so I've read a bunch of it.
Yeah.
This was my favorite thing that she's ever written. It's huge. It's long. It's called Out of the Clear Blue Sky. And it's still in hardback, so you might want to go library with it. Or it really would make a great gift for a reading, probably female relative. It's a very much women's story, divorce, very badly behaving ex-husband who eventually, it's got all the satisfying bits as well, though. I really enjoyed it. It was one of those books where you're like, what did I like about this so much? Besides the fact that it's well-written and it's a great story and it's good, like it has all the basics, but it also sort of delivers punches on the whole, satisfying you on a bunch of things that it's fun
to
get satisfied. So it's just a super fun and also pleasantly long, like it'd be a great one to pull out for the holiday vacation.
Well, it's getting close to hardcore winter time. So that's a good one. Mm-hmm, that's a good mm-hmm. one.
Yeah. You know, travel, good plane book. Garrett, this is a lock for a plane. Like you're going to look up and be like, oh, we're landing. Sorry.
I love it. I'm always in awe of writers who can like turn out books quickly. And it sounds like from what you're describing, that's what she does.
Yeah. She's pretty much one of those book a year authors. And I say that, I mean, that's what I want to be. She's a book of years. She's done a lot. She also has a hysterical podcast that I have recommended before to people if you are interested in writing fiction, because it's called Crappy Friends. And she and Joss Day, who is her best friend and also a commercial fiction author, people write them letters. They write these long sagas of horrible friendship that's gone wrong. And then she and Joss Day give advice, and it's just deeply funny. And also it's like, oh God, there's a novel in every one of those. I know why y'all do this.
I have a question KJ. I have a question for you, which is, why does one novel a year become something that is a pull? Why is that something that is on your radar? Is it because then you get to keep your readers wanting more of your fiction? Is that the goal? Is it more that you have so many stories burning that you want to get them out? Like, what is your motivation for that? I'm fascinated by it because I don't do fiction. Tell me about that.
Oh, I think it's definitely the wanting to keep the readers. I would just love to be one of those authors where people are like, when's the new Ellen Hildebrand coming out? And Kristen Higgins is like that. I would love to see, you know, I don't know that people like go in and ask when it's coming, but people are like, ooh, a new Kristen Higgins.
Right.
And so it's becoming the kind of author for whom the author's name, you know, look, it's bigger than the title.
Yes.
So that's what you want. That's what I want anyway. But a parallel of that, like a flip side, is that those authors tend to write the same kind of book. And it's not clear to me, you know, I'm only on novel number 3. And honestly, it's a little different than 1 and 2. So I don't know whether I'll be able to sort of, whether I'll want to stay on the same train in a way that would mean that if you liked one of my books, you'll like the other ones. But it's a great, it's a good goal. My agent says a book every year and a half is good.
Wow.
But then you're not the summer book, or you're not Like, the, you know, people buy their mom the new Ella Hildebrand for Christmas every year, kind of
thing. You know, you are amazing because we started our conversation talking about my pivot, but look at your pivot.
Suddenly you're interviewing me.
No, but seriously.
Part two.
It's remarkable. I mean, I'm sitting here watching from afar and you've done it and you're doing it. And I find that to be just really inspiring.
Well, thank you. It is a fun thing about the podcast that you can listen to it in real time, I guess. Yeah, it's been a trip, but one I've enjoyed.
Applause to you. Applause to you.
Thank you. I'll take it. We'll all take it. Well, kids, if you're on your own writing journey and making your own pivot or whatever you're doing to make it happen, I'm so glad that you were here with us today to talk to Allison, to hear about the extremely inspirational Elsie Robinson. So let's see, new podcast stuff. We're chatting now. So if you head into the Substack app, there's a chat. And you can go in there and post the same kind of stuff you might put on Instagram or Twitter, only I'll answer you and other people will answer you and you'll talk and it'll be great. And no one will suddenly blindside you with an ad for, a cat suitcase, which actually I really like getting ads for cat suitcases, which is why I click on them. So I get, you know, clear-sighted rolling cat suitcases instead of all the other possibilities that Instagram could offer me. But anyway, no ads. We're really happy with Substack at the moment. So if you've been in the Facebook group, maybe you'd like to just try the Substack thing. The links for that will be available in the show notes. You should definitely be subscribing to the show notes. There's all kinds of different stuff that comes via email now, including weekly ride-alongs, which is a new thing that has been happening and that's been doing great for me and great for a bunch of the rest of us. So if you want to write with me on Zoom, if you want to chat, if you want to chat with Jess and Serena, all of those things are available, but you should definitely subscribe. And yeah, that's it. So you're a listener. If I challenge you, can you take us out with the catchphrase? I'm putting you on the spot. Take a breath. Okay.
Yes, I'm going to try.
Okay, it's okay.
Put your butt in the chair and leave your head in the game.
That's it. You're done. Woo! All right, everybody. Thanks so much for listening. See y'all next week.
The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Listeners, if you're not already signed up to get our emails, you should be. Last week, email subscribers got links to 3 pop-up ride-alongs with me, KJ, and there are more coming, along with thoughts on revision, TikTok, and more that'll only go out to subscribers. Pop your name on the list at amwritingpodcast.com.